It's the Best of the 250s edition of Radio Free Thinker, a recast of some of the best segments from shows 250 to 259. This week's best flashbacks are Facebook Censoring Experiment, Justin and the Pope, The Dirty Dozen, Prostitution Law Take 2, and GMOs and You. Let's begin.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the great Facebook experiment. Many of you may now be aware that Facebook has been experimenting on you without explicit consent. It has the EULA, or the End User License Agreement, that we all just sort of click on when we really don't really read it at all. So I guess it does seem to have an implicit consent, I guess. Much of the talk has been focused on the full rage about another corporation manipulating people for its own aims. But I could not help but notice, but the real story was somehow being missed. You see, what Facebook did was manipulate your feed so that you would see more positive or negative posts. The goal was to see whether this would affect your own posting. Now, the commentary all focused on two points. One, how much control we've given over to these mega daddy corporations, and doesn't this make you angry? There was some rage about how they may have used our personal information without us knowing it, but Facebook claims it went through a proper procedure to ensure that all data was anonymized. Much comparison was made to Google. The other stream, which was intended to diffuse the rage created in the first point, is that everyone is doing it. Then they would say, well, the CBC will alter the color of its logo, change the arrangements of web elements, write stories in different ways, all of which is data used to improve the site or increase its traffic. Fair enough, but there is one point, a major point, being overlooked. They manipulated your news feeds. What is a news feed? Well, to be honest, in most other contexts, it's like a streaming Google search. In that context, most of us know that based on our past searches, any future search will be edited, manipulated, so as to reflect our interests and their economic goals. But a Facebook newsfeed is not like newsfeeds you'd get from the CBC, where I trust them to send me what they think I would like to see. A Facebook newsfeed is from people, groups, and pages I subscribe to. It's not passive, but active. It's not their content, but our content. The real analogy is not the CBC News or Google, but Canada Post. So when they say they manipulated my feed, what they are really saying is they opened up all the mail sent to me. Then they tossed those that were, for example, positive. Not all, but enough for the experiment. Then they resealed the letters and sent them on to me. That is not experimentation. That's censoring my mail or email. Did my cousin have a baby? I might not know because I had reached my positive quota for that day. Your grandma died and I didn't send my condolences? Sorry, but my negative quota was reached. Let me reiterate. A Facebook newsfeed is not news, but messages sent to me by my request and the posters. It's not Facebook's content. It's our content. And that should really piss people off. And why didn't anybody else pick up on this? I asked my fellow Facebook users, and what did they say? Silence. Okay, the conspiracy person inside of me seriously wonders if maybe that posting was censored in itself. So then I asked a few friends, and I was gobsmacked. They said, oh yeah, what was the problem again? I said, how do you feel that Facebook was editing your status feeds? The response of one is to go into a long debate about how they were not editing the feeds, but just deleting them. What the feck? So to be clear, they were not editing the actual comments, but they were editing the feed itself. That is, some updates got thrown, others did not. Then they quibbled about the mail analogy, that if I sent a message directly to you, and that would not be on the feed, well, that would go through, so what was the problem? If I really wanted to know what you had said, I could go to your own personal page and see all the postings there. The reply is to point out that updates are like mass emails to your friends. So again, I do not understand why there is not a sliver of concern. Something. But no, it was just meh. Then I comment that maybe it's a generational thing, that the concept of privacy has a very different meaning. They replied, sadly accurately, that there's no such thing as privacy anymore. It's more than that. This is an absence of freedom, the willing abdication of the right to do or say as you wish, and the apathy to no longer care. The clinking sound as the chain closes around the necks of the next generation. What's your comments on this? Am I really that out of it? Send your comments to info@radiofreethinker.com or post them on our Facebook page. I'd really like to know what's up.
This is Phil Plait of badastronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Hello, and we're back. Now, as our listeners may know, I'm not a big fan of religion. On the show, we have more than once crossed swords with the biggest religion, Catholicism. So it may not surprise you that I have an opinion about a recent debate that has occurred with one of our elected party leaders. Yes, I'm referring to Justin Trudeau and his stance on abortion. Now, it seems that Justin is a good Catholic, like devout Catholic, as was his father before him, who apparently would read Bible passages to the kids as a fun thing. To quote Justin, "I had an extraordinary example in a father who had deeply, deeply held personal views that were informed by the fact that he went to church every Sunday, read the Bible regularly to us, and raised us as very religious as Catholic. So you think that his attitude towards abortion would be, never is too much." Well, it seems that Justin, like his father believed, if I may paraphrase, the government has no business in a woman's uterus. Both were publicly pro-choice, while personally against abortion. The father believed, and the son believes, that as a leader of the nation, they're there to promote the nation's interest, and not their theocratic ones. Again, to quote Justin, "He too held fast to his beliefs. But at the same time, my father had no problem legalizing divorce, decriminalizing homosexuality, and moving in ways to recognize the basic rights of people. He understood that as leader, as a political figure, and as a representative of the larger community, our utmost responsibility is to stand up for people's rights." And for that, I commend him. But I'm still not voting liberal. But from here, it becomes complicated, and you might want to sit down for this one. Why this is news, firstly, is Justin has denied the application of a liberal candidate on the grounds that that person is anti-abortion. You'll never hear me actually use the term pro-life as a description because these people usually are not pro-life because they're also pro-capital punishment. And that's a biased word. Anti-abortion is accurate and I don't think it's really judgmental. So I'm a bit torn on this one. I've talked before how Harper, as party leader, essentially can dictate to the MPs because they require his signature on their nomination papers. This is a power held by all party leaders. And it would seem to me to be hypocritical if I didn't complain about Justin using it in this case, although I do support his reasoning. The original logic of the sign-off was to ensure that local constituent associations could not nominate, or more embarrassingly, elect candidates who were in opposition either to the party leader or the main party doctrines. It also provided a way for parties, via the leader, to filter out cranks or embarrassing nominees who may be overtly racist or the like. As a side note, the party leaders only gained this power in 1993, so we're not talking about some long-standing tradition. But getting back to Justin, I am sure Justin saw himself justified under both of the reasons I've mentioned. But should this power be vested into one person's hand, even a group of hands? In a very real way, this is democracy thwarted. The party members of the riding, where the individual comes from, are now denied the opportunity to select the castaway as their nominee. The people of the riding are denied the opportunity to send their candidate to Ottawa. You know, thinking about it, I cannot help but wonder if the situations were kind of reversed. what if Justin denied the nomination of a pro-choice candidate? I can excuse Justin in this case because, as he rightly pointed out, the nomination should have been squashed at the local level because the candidate does not believe in the fundamental rights of Canadians, and the possibility of his election would be corrosive to those rights. Now, it would normally end on some great oratorical magnificence, but this story has developed more. As I mentioned, Justin is a Catholic, and maybe we should ban all people of religion from holding office. Why such a radical call? Well, it started with the Archbishop of Toronto requesting that Justin allow nominees to exercise their consciousness. Code words for letting people express their biases and bigotry. However, this was taken up a couple of notches when the Archbishop of Ottawa saw this as a kind of outing of Justin as a pro-choice supporter. He referred to Trudeau as scandalous to be both a practicing Catholic and pro-choice. He even threatened to deny communion, perhaps even excommunication of Justin, if he did not change his ways. The Archbishop of Ottawa said if the Liberal leader continued to practice his Catholic faith in the form of receiving communion, it would be unseemly. Quote, ultimately, he would have to make a public traction of his views. It's the fact that he considers himself a devout Catholic, but then adheres to or advocates for abortion. At no point does Justin advocate or adhere to abortion. His stance is, I may assume, I, Justin, think abortion is wrong, but that's my belief, and you're free to have your own. The Toronto Archbishop said, quote, political leaders surely have a right to insist on party unity in political matters which are with legislative scope of their authority. But that political authority is not limitless. It does not extend to matters of consciousness and religious faith. I find it so ironic that some complain about people suppressing their right to suppress other people's rights. And religion is again trying to carve out a special space where common decency and reason are not allowed to operate. But getting back to my point, I will assume that Justin is not really Catholic, or perhaps a cultural Catholic, as so many people and especially politicians are today. So this will not likely cause him to change his views. But what if he really, really, really was Catholic, believed in the whole heaven and hell thing? Do we really want to have a Prime Minister of Canada, someone who puts the dictates of Rome ahead of those of the people? You see, if you believe in hell, well, irrespective of the harm you might believe that will be done in this world by your actions, the reward of true faith will always outweigh that. This is one of the reasons that I suspect pedophiles were allowed to go unchecked in the church, in, well, all religions, because whatever harm that might be done to the small child is nothing compared to an eternity of damnation if they somehow question their faith. The root of the logic is that protecting the church is more important than anything. Praise be to Jesus. We'll return after this break.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
I was rather surprised recently when some loyal listener proclaimed, slightly triumphantly and fairly remorsefully, that they were giving up regular apples from now on. It was only organic apples for them. What brought on this dietary revolution? Well, they pointed me to an article on the CBC website. It was titled, The Dirty Dozen, the top 15 list of pesticide contamination in 2015. From the CBC website, it explained that the report was published by the US-based Environmental Working Group. It states the group is a non-profit organization that acts as a public health and environmental watchdog, monitoring consumer products, food, and the environmental practices. Londar claims that the organization has been looking out at the safety of pesticides on fruits and vegetables for over a decade, based on data gathered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Food and Drug Administration. Oh yes, Londar is Sonia Londar. It's EWG's senior analysis. So far sounds legit. Continue with the article. This year's data found that a single conventionally grown grape grown in the United States contained 15 pesticides, and an average potato had more pesticides by weight than any other food tested. Londar said, this is the fourth year where we've had apples on the top of the Dirty Dozen list, meaning they have the most pesticides and the highest concentrations of them. The article goes on to say, in addition to being sold in the produce section, these are the same apples that are processed into baby food, pressed into apple juice. Many are also exported to China, Mexico, and Canada, implying that it's not just our own lives and health that are at risk, but we're taking the health of innocent babies into our hands. On this theme, the article states, citing research that links childhood exposure to pesticides with behavioral problems, decreased cognitive function, and pediatric cancers, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended parents to take steps to reduce pesticide exposure in the home, which includes using lists like the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 while shopping in the produce aisle. In fact, Launder states that the AAP endorsed the work being done by the EWG, which I find kind of weird. You see, I went to the AAP website. They do have a campaign against pesticide residue on food, but from the kind you or I might buy in Canadian Tire and use on our lawns and gardens, not so much from the food you purchase in the supermarket. There are only two mentions of the EWG or the Dirty Dozen on the AAP website, and they seem to be simply a link added in the same non-critical or reflexive way that the CBC has published this story. And this perhaps gets to the meat of the segment. How do we assess these kinds of stories? First, I should point out that the CBC article was really just a reworking of a press release from the EWG with some quote thrown in. There was no attempt to validate any of the claims nor provide any kind of balance. Balance, you may say? Between whom? Well, on the one side, you'd have Big Agra, which, of course, we should be skeptical of. But on the other is Big Organic, which also requires a touch of skepticism. The U.S. market for organic foods has grown from $3.5 billion in 1996 to $28.6 billion in 2010, according to the Organic Trades Association. Now, the Environmental Working Group do provide a list of their financial supporters, which is a credible list of donors. However, one must wonder if this list is window dressing, because they do add the caveat. It's only a partial list. Why only a partial list? Maybe it's only groups who gave $1,000 or more. Or maybe they have links with organic corporations. We just don't know. Yes, yes, you may say. That's very ad hominem of you, Don. And yes. So I then took a look at the original publication. It's not a research document that the CBC used, but more of a marketing brochure. Okay, perhaps marketing is a bit of a loaded term, but it is a brightly colored pamphlet with lots of requests for donations. There is a minimum number of references, and all of them to the supposed health risk. I would liken it to the kind of literature that's put out by the anti-vax movement. But I'm not going to debate the possible risk of pesticides and herbicides. In fact, I'm sure refer to them as toxins from here on out, because they can be toxic at certain levels. Note there, certain levels. Now, at first, I could not actually find the source of their data. So in lieu of that, I tried to find stories that debunked the Dirty Dozen. I found two relatively quickly. I noted that they had as sources of their data as the USDA's Pesticide Data Program. Launder explains that, and I quote here, the information wasn't formatted in a way people without scientific degree or course in statistics could really take any conclusions away from. And therein lies the rub, conclusions. They have an agenda, which again is not necessarily bad. I often have an agenda, but it's important to be aware of that agenda. So then I went and I checked some of their other causes that the Environmental Working Group has, what kind of campaigns it does. And I found some warning flags, like the unsubstantiated claim that cell phones cause cancer, tumors, brain damages, and infertility, and a similar stance on GMOs. They also have a thing against ethanol and bottled water, so not all bad. And I should mention this now. I'm not claiming this group is pure bull, but because their science and critical thinking is weak, they have some things wrong, and maybe they have some things right, but not on this one. Which leads me back to the debunking stories I found. One was published by a farming lobby, a biased source, and the other was a blog site that had no obvious links. But why should I trust these debunking stories any more credibly than I do the Dirty Dozen? Well, I shouldn't. But as I said, they did lead me to the source material for the articles. I went to the USDA site, downloaded the data, and analyzed it. I'm going to make another ad hominem here, but with a purpose. I mentioned that Lauder is the senior analysis. She has a master's in public health, an online course that is not clinical or even really scientific in nature, but more managerial and public relations. What caught my eye was in a short blurb about her on their website, it pointed out, and again, I must quote here, during her tenure at EWG, Sonia has personally field-tested dozens of EWG-rated sunscreens on herself and her two sons. So the highlight of her academic career at the EWG was to try on some sunscreens. And it's not even science. It's the epitome of anecdotal evidence. So much for double-blinded studies. Let's just slap on some and see how we feel. Okay, what has that got to do with anything? Well, it seems she has little more academic credibility to do the analysis of the data than I do. And here's where I started to wonder. I looked at the data, and I found no smoking gun, no lethal levels of anything. Then I went back, and I reread the claims. They did not actually say they were toxic levels of any of the chemicals mentioned. In fact, they only stated that they found traces of those many chemicals. So apples were the most toxic, not because of the concentration of contaminants they were laden with, but the number of them. Oh, I see. They did not care if the levels of contamination was high enough to actually pose a risk to health, but only if there was any there at all, which is kind of another sign that you're dealing with biased, unfounded, or outright dishonest reporting. They take special note of diphenylamine, which they say is banned in the EU and can cause a whole host of health problems, which is true, but the EU does allow a maximum level of 100 parts per billion on imported products. And again, this leads to an important distinction, risk to the farm workers versus risk to the consumer. Much credit to the EWG. They make the point that the risk of many of these chemicals are greatest for the people who work with the crops, which is why the EU banned the use of it, but will still allow its import. Perhaps not the most ethical thing on the part of the EU, too toxic for our workers, but it's okay if it harms their workers. So when they single out apples as the worst, part of it is on how many trace chemicals there are, and about trace elements. I hate to tell you this, folks, but there are trace amounts of rat, cockroach in any number of packaged foods. Your hand-picked organic lettuce will almost certainly have feces material from a host of different animals, including humans. There are trace amounts of radioactive material in everyone's bones born between 1945 and 1970. Thank you, above-ground nuclear testing. I mentioned on a recent show that bananas have radioactive potassium. So trace amounts are meaningless. What we want to know is how much, not how many. In fact, in a 2010 scientific study published in the Journal of Toxicity, they actually reviewed the Dirty Dozen list. They found that the methodology of the report was fatally flawed. Basically, I just covered that. But they went further to answer the question, how much? The highest relative exposure for a pesticide slash commodity combination was the organic phosphate insecticide methotrexate on bell peppers. The reference dose, maximum acceptable oral dose of a toxic substance, or the RDF, for methotrexate, was 49.5 times higher than the actual exposure estimate, indicating a large measure of consumer protection. So essentially, the amount they found on the peppers was 1/50th the maximum allowable dose. Let's take the example used earlier and pointed out by Laudner, the phenylamine, used to coat the skins of apples to prevent breakdown during storage. The acceptable daily intake of diphenylamine is 75 micrograms per kilogram per day, which for an average person in Canada would be about 6 milligrams per day. Rough calculations state that your apple has about 1/10,000th of a milligram. So you would need to eat 60 apples a day over a long period of time to have any kind of health risk. And I should point out, my calculations are out actually by quite a bit, maybe an order of magnitude or more, because I assume the pesticide is evenly distributed throughout the fruit, where in fact it's only on the outer surface. Let's look at it another way. The Environmental Protection Agency sets the exposure limit to 10,000 parts per billion. In the test data used for the Dirty Dozen, the same toxic apples only had 100 parts per billion. Now let's return to the beginning. As I said, this all started as a post at the CBC. Now, considering the recent budget cuts, I might have excused this as just lazy reporting, passing off a press release as reporting. I would if it were not for the addition of another quote study. This one was harder to track down and not reported, in at least the other ones that reported the Dirty Dozen. So it seems to be something that was added almost uniquely to the CBC report, which means it was maybe more than just copying and pasting a press release. This study claims to show that switching to an organic diet will reduce organophosphates in your body by almost 90%. Wow! But the study was so flawed, I almost laughed. It was done on a group of only 13 people. Half ate conventional food, while the other half ate a diet of at least 80% organic foods. After a week, The group switched diets. But wait a minute, only a week and only 13 people? Far from convincing. Also lacking was the actual numbers. I didn't actually couldn't find the actual report itself. I could only find a report on the report. And even if there were a reduction, and that seems not to be unreasonable, but if you went from one part in a billion to 0.1 part in a billion, yet the safe level was one part in a billion, well, I don't really see the significance. I should, again, more ad hominem, note the author of this study has her credentials in natural medicine. So weak on the whole idea of science, and judging from her professional affiliations, far from an unbiased source. So back to the CBC. It saddens me that such a piece of crap could have been reported uncritically and with such a lack of scientific knowledge. It took me 3 minutes to raise red flags about this story, another hour or three to completely debunk it. If only we gave the CBC the money it needed to do the job we needed to do. Keep Canadians intelligently informed. We'll return after this break.
The Westside Community Food Market is a small farmer's market located on West 8th Avenue and Vine Street, where you can find a myriad of local organic produce and gourmet homemade treats like canned black currant jelly or freshly baked bread. Every Thursday from 3 to 6 p.m. until September 19th, and is sponsored by Society Promoting Environmental Conversation and Kids Neighborhood House.
And we're back. Just when you thought it was safe to go to the brothel, the Harper government strikes again. Canada may once again do something that will make it unique in the world. We're about to enact a law that will make it legal to sell a product while simultaneously making it illegal to buy. Institutionalized state-sponsored entrapment. What is the product? Sex services, aka prostitution. This law is in response to the Supreme Court striking down a previous law on the topic. To refresh our listeners about that ruling, let's reminisce. The applicants, the people who challenged the law, were arguing that several laws violated their Charter of Rights. The respondent, the government wanting to uphold the law, argued that it could limit the rights based on Section 1 of the Charter, which states, "The Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in it subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society." The court, in testing to see if the limitation is valid, uses what is called the Oaks test, named after the case where it was first heard. The first test holds that there must be a, quote, pressing and substantial objective. For example, the desire to protect minorities from hate speech. If the court agrees that there is a suitable objective, the Crown then must show proportionality. Proportionality is actually three things. First, the restriction in question must be related to achieving the objective. For example, preventing someone from driving because they're a shoplifter, there's no rational connection between the two. Whereas preventing someone from driving who's an alcoholic might be a stronger case. Second, it must be as minimal as possible. For example, a rehabilitated, i.e. lawfully released from prison, child sex offender could be prohibited from going into any public park. But that's a large limitation. A more minimal limitation would be prohibiting them from school areas. This achieves the law's objective while not being too onerous on the charter. Lastly, it must be proportional to the objective. For example, the objective of stopping jaywalking, a minor offense, should have an equally minor limitation on rights, whereas stopping hate speech, a major offense, could support a greater limitation on rights. Okay, now that you have a brief understanding of the Charter, let's just say the court did not believe these laws deserve Section 1 protection and thus struck them down. The laws in question were, 1. Anyone who keeps a common body house, a place that is kept for the purpose of prostitution or the practice of acts of, quote, indecency, is guilty of indictable offense. This extends to the, quote, inmates, i.e. workers, landlords, and anyone found without lawful excuse, who are to be liable to summary convictions. 2. Everyone who lives wholly or in part on the avails of prostitution of another person. 3. Every person who, in a public place or in any place open to public view, attempts to communicate for the purpose of engaging in prostitution or obtaining the sexual services of a prostitute, is punishable by a summary conviction. These laws were, in a way, quite strange. I can understand if you were left with the impression prostitution itself was illegal in Canada. Yet it's not. Prostitution itself is legal in Canada. They have just written the law so that you can't actually practice it. Well, above board. So in response to this ruling, the Harper government has introduced legislation that will reverse the wording of the law while ensuring that nothing actually changes, that the environment for prostitution remains as dangerous as before. What's in the law? It will ban the selling of sex anywhere that people under 18 are found. This is pretty broad. It should be noted that, well, kids can really go everywhere. Okay, maybe not bars or adult bookstores. And you might say that's good. Treat the sex trade like liquor stores. That would be progressive. But the Conservative Party jettisoned their progressiveness a decade ago. I think that we can all agree that you don't want sex workers hanging out in the schoolyard. Teenagers might argue with this, but for the most part, we can agree that the sex trade should be treated like alcohol or some cigarettes. Also in the bill, police would be given a new power to search for and seize advertising material for the sale of sex, a provision that could be used to raid escort services, which now operate virtually in the open. Let me state that again. It will make it illegal to advertise sexual services. Right now, if you look at the classified section of most, quote, street papers, the ones you get for free, sort of the Georgia Strait, the Extra, well, sex works are plainly visible plying their trade like any other business people. Under this law, that would be illegal. In fact, the law would put sex worker advertisements in the same category as child porn and snuff vids. Side note, I discovered that voyeuristic recordings are also classified as the same as child pornography and, once again, snuff films. That is, if you videotape your kids or a friend's kid, no sex involved, then sell that vid, you could be arrested. I understand the intent of this idea, but what if I'm selling a vid of a local soccer team, wrestling team, swim team? It also makes distribution a crime, irrespective of the exchange of money. So if someone takes a vid of their kid winning at some of the mentioned events, then send it out, like a proud parent might, to friends or family, they could be charged. Getting back to banning advertising, something that has been de facto legal. This law, at least in this regards, is more regressive than the one it is trying to replace. In fact, much of the legislation seems obsessed with sex worker advertisement. But of course, this law has nothing to do with helping women or sex workers, many of whom are men, but in promoting an ideological Christian morality. More on that later. The law has potential jail sentences for up to 5 years for sex workers who advertise, and the people who take their advertisements. By making advertising of sex work illegal, this will make it impossible for these people to work in the relative safety of their homes, severely limiting their ability to vet prospective clients. Basically, it will force the sex workers onto the streets to ply their trade. If women's safety were the real point of this, then why is this part of the bill? It is basically pointing a legal gun to those people who have found a safe way to practice their trade. But of course, it is a gun the government wants to use, not to make their lives safer, but to dictate a narrow-minded Christian ethic that plays so well to the conservative base. One might get the impression that election is on the horizon. Previously, the struck-down law tried to criminalize the sale of sex. This law reverses that by criminalizing the buying of sex, with steep fines to jail sentences of up to 5 years. The government line is that it is trying to send a message to Johns that buying sex is not only wrong, but now a crime. Sex workers do not want their clients arrested for trying to purchase sexual services. They do want their clients arrested when they are violent, abusive, or exploitative. Pimping is still a crime, but the hiring of accountants and bodyguards would be allowed. It also seems to excuse the partners, lifetime partners, i.e. spouses, legal or technical, from being convicted. This may be a perverse outcome of having real pimps, the cartoon villainy types, forcing their whore to marry them so as to protect their profit margin. It apparently does not apply to a person who receives the benefit, i.e. money or goods, in the context of a legitimate living arrangement with the person from whose sexual services the benefit is derived. That said, I may have misinterpreted the text. It could also mean if you pay your wife for sex, you will not be convicted. The line itself states this, and I'm going to point out right here, if some of these wordings seem a bit odd, I'm trying to lift as much from the original text of the law as I can, so forgive some of the bad grammar and oddly sounding phrases. But going back, one of the lines in the law states, a person who engages in conduct in relations to any person that would constitute an offense under section 286.3, i.e. sex for money, is exempt if the context of a legitimate living arrangement with that person from whose sexual service the benefit is derived. And I think benefit refers to money or goods, and services are, well, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more, say no more. They roll back some of these exceptions when they add another line that states, no exception for those who receive the benefit in the context of a commercial enterprise that offers sexual services for consideration. So if you in any way help your partner ply their trade, you can no longer expect to be exempt from the law. This would also, I think, rule out any kind of sort of sex worker cooperative. Two things that have been shown to make sex work safer. Now, it's important to define what a pimp is under this law. Everyone who receives a financial or other material benefit, knowing it is obtained by or derived directly or indirectly from sexual services. So under the old law, sex workers had to find dark places for fear of arrest if they conducted business in the light. You see, if a sex worker wanted to set up shop, they can't rent a store or even a hotel room. Why? Well, if the owner of the place knows, they automatically become the pimp. Similarly, if they wanted to hire someone to do background checks on prospective clients, well, those people too become pimps. This law makes little to no change to this problem. Yes, they can hire a bodyguard, but not a room to ply their trade. They can hire an accountant, but they can't place an ad or even have someone screen clients. You cannot solicit in public. The law states, everyone is guilty of an offense who, in a public place or in public view, for the purposes of offering or providing sexual services. So let's recap. The law will prevent you from renting a place to do your work. You cannot advertise your services. You can't even do the old classic street walk, at least in open places. So what else is there? As a result of this law, street-based sex work will be the target of law enforcement and can be arrested. They will be displaced into dangerous and isolated parts of the city where they are more likely to work alone in order to avoid police detection. Sex workers will rush to get into vehicles without taking the time to screen clients and negotiate the terms of the transaction, resulting in much greater risk of harm. Sex workers will also face barriers to police protection as a result of their criminalization. This law is not intended to make sex workers' life safer, but, if I may channel Harper, to punish them for the immoral whores they are. The government's claim they are only concerned with women in danger is not only hypocritical, loathsome, repulsive, but it's an obscene act of deceit. They will have to once again go to these dark places because that is where their clientele will be for fear of arrest. Because, let's recap, the government would ban indecent activity rather than sex in body houses. What is indecent? Well, in the immortal words of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. That's the angst for you. In Canada, well, we're different. According to R.V. LeBay, in Canadian law, morality has no place in determining whether these activities were indecent. According to Canadian law, we use an objective standard which is concerned with whether any harm is being done. Put in another way, indecency in Canadian law is something that threatens someone's liberty, exposes something undesirable to people, forces someone to commit a misdeed, or harms someone engaged in certain acts. The court said the threshold for harm should be set high, that some things that certain Canadians will not like should be allowed to exist unless it becomes so serious it threatens the society. In anticipation of a constitutional challenge, the government rewrote the law's purpose in a way that judges hearing any future constitutional challenge would need to keep in mind, promoting human dignity and equality and protecting children and communities. Here we start to see the hidden message in the law. First, I can't help but note that much of legislation is redundant. We have laws already about child prostitution, child labor, slave labor, be it sex workers or sweatshop. There's a joke in there somewhere, but I'll reframe. The topic's kind of too serious. Other parts are just ideological. Why can I be harassed by people trying to sell phones on the street, or worse, Jesus in as many disguises? But if I want a hand job, I've got to ask it in code or go into some dark place like where I buy my pot. It's already illegal to do it in public. So what harm is there? And once again, Harper's imposing minimum sentences, taking away the discretion of judges, and just being an ass. Minimum sentences are punitive and vengeful and have no place in a civilized society. which perhaps tells you the direction Harper hopes to take this great nation. If you drug a person to have sex, or get them to have sex with others, well, the drugging part is already a crime, and sex without consent, i.e. under the influence, is also a crime. Sex with minors? It's a crime. Forcing someone to do anything, be it sex or sewing, is slavery, and that is already illegal. They go to great pains to ensure that the providers of these services, the prostitutes themselves, are exempt from most of the convictions. That is, if a person places an ad to sell sex, they are immune to prosecution, even though the paper that runs the ad and the person responding to the ad are all up for jail time. This is almost the opposite of our attitude towards drugs, mostly pot, that we should make it not criminal to buy a joint, but illegal to sell one. Justice Minister Peter McKay states, quote, "Today our government is making prostitution illegal for the first time. We are criminalizing the purchase of sexual services and in very specific instances the sale, in areas where young people under the age of 18 could be present." Okay, so that's the law. But the elephant in the room, I think, is sexism or misogyny. It is men telling women that what they do is immoral and that needs to end. Peter McKay said it overtly, and I am sure unintentionally, when he said the bill recognizes that the vast majority of those who sell sexual services do not do so by choice. We view the vast majority of those involved in selling sexual services as victims. Women as victims. Where have I heard that one before? Oh my, women are weak and they need a man like Peter McKay to save them from their life choices. As already said, things like trafficking of workers, be they sex slaves or factory slaves, is already illegal. And last time I went to high school, trying to have sex with a minor was still illegal. The only good thing about the bill is the $20 million that is provided to help those people who are sex workers out of necessity. If only they could find that kind of money for people who work at McDonald's because they have to, or those who have to clean the shit out of Peter McKay's cabin outhouse. The result of an online consultation that showed two-thirds of more than 31,000 respondents said selling sex should not be an offense. But remember, the trick Harper is playing is not to criminalize the sale, but the advertisement and purchase of sex. Katrina Pacey, a lawyer for Pivot Legal Society, said, "This is in fact full criminalization of prostitution, which is going to result in sex workers going to jail. But that's okay. They're only immoral sinners doomed to hell." Oops, sorry about that. I'm channeling Harper again. Well, let's be fair. Harper's not a moral person. What I am channeling is the constituency base he's hoping to solidify for the next election. McKay said, "No model that involved full decriminalization or legalization will ever make prostitution a safe endeavor. The real problem is misogyny. Every time I hear that prostitution or pornography is an evil, it's because it objectifies women, it demeans women. Well, no, it does not. Not any more than we have women nannies or women housekeepers. It's not the profession, but the gender that we seem to have a problem with." Let me clarify. Women do get objectified, and female pornography is a salient example of this. But let's not confuse cause with effect. One could argue mothers are objectified because they are not seen as individuals in their own right, but just someone who cleans the house, feeds the kids, and warms the bed. The real issue is sexism and misogyny. Nowhere in the bill is this addressed. Now, they do make a valuable point. Not everyone works in the profession for the love of the job. Sometimes they do so because that is the only job that they can get that provides food and shelter. And no one wants to have people be slaves to the job, be it sex work, McDonald's, or cleaning McKay's cabin crapper. So the provision of $20 million for sex workers to find different work is a good thing. But again, it does not address the real issue, poverty, racism, sexism. If they want to provide money for people who want to escape unwanted professions, well, that should apply equally to the fry flinger, the toilet cleaner, and, if they wish a different job, the prostitute. As a guy, there is nothing this law is addressing, at least logically or morally. If I want to get it on with a chick or a dude and have them pay me money, well, that seems okay. After all, I'm a man, and I have dominion over my body. But if I'm a weaker, more exploited female, well, then my consensual sex is an act of oppression. The irony is the attitude of oppression, that women cannot control their lives, that they need special protection. Every time I hear that porn degrades women, I have to ask, what about gay porn? Okay, on one level, it is instrumental, but the objectification argument is incoherent. If I watch gay porn, am I objectifying myself? Am I no longer me, but it? It makes no sense in and of itself. nor do I think that the performers see themselves as objects any more than a model, an athlete, or a singer. That said, and I feel I must repeat this point, women are treated as objects. It has nothing to do with sex, pornography, or sex work in and of themselves, but how these professions are allowed to be practiced. It's like saying that slaves are abused while picking cotton, so we should outlaw cotton. That gets at the symptom, but not the root cause. You see, there is an irony here. The conservatives, be they Harper or your local pastor, they want to save women from the harms of prostitution. Yet those harms arise because of the moral and legal constraints that are placed upon the profession. At one time, alcohol was deemed immoral and was outlawed in the USA. That very criticism made it even an even greater evil than they claimed that it was. No longer was there food and safety oversight to ensure that the product was safe for human consumption. You could no longer go to your local pub to have a pint. Now you had to go to some back alley dive. And worst of all, you no longer had law-abiding, tax-paying businesses, but criminal organizations that ensured market dominance not via advertising, but the end of a gun. Prohibition made these mobsters billionaires. It is the moral drive to criminalize normal behavior that can turn that activity into the detriment they fear. Ultimately, this law will, and let me say this with emphasis, will be repealed by the Supreme Court because it perpetuates all the harms while continuing the stigmatization of the trade. This, like Harper's hyper support for Israel and the new west-facing Ukraine, a simple but obvious and immoral play for a key demographic. Harper is always thinking about the next election and how he can manipulate it for his aims. The nation of Canada be damned. His will, his ego, is sacrosanct. 2015, never forget. We'll be right back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
And we're back. Okay, there's been a lot of talk and fear-mongering and just plain confusion over the idea of GMOs. We have talked before about GMOs, but more tangentially or related to articles here or there. So I thought today we would take a complete rundown on the issue. To start with, we should define what we mean by GMOs. Well, the acronym stands for genetically modified organism. Okay, I know what genes are. They're the building blocks of life, your DNA. And I know, roughly speaking, what an organism is. Something that is alive and reproduces. Okay, we could argue about what is life, but this should suffice for our conversation. Then things get a little fuzzy when we try to define modified. First, nature itself is a great genetic experimenter. The whole primary axiom of evolution is based upon genetic modification. Granted, this is largely done via natural mutations that arise from miscopied DNA, cosmic rays, chemical toxins, all that have the power to mutate our genes, quote, naturally. Important note there, naturally. Of course, you can also get a bit of gene splicing via bacteria, and you can also get hybrids. By hybrids, I mean when you have, as recently happened, a donkey and a zebra breed to produce a zonkey. You can get the same thing when a lion and a tiger, a grizzly or a polar bear. And hard to believe you can get a wolpin when a false killer whale and a dolphin has conjugal or commingling, you know, they get it on. Of course, this is natural and we have no issues with this. Although, if you think about it, natural genetic manipulation also created the Black Death, smallpox, nightshade, poison ivy, the black widow spider, and the cobra. So, let's not all fall into the naturalistic fallacy that just because it's, quote, natural, it must be good. It's not necessarily so. But not all of this type of genetic modification can lay at the feet of nature. humanity, over its millions of years, well, okay, at least the last tens of thousands of years of agriculture, have been modifying life forms to serve our own purposes. The banana is probably the best example. If you look at a natural wild banana, well, they are small, they have large seeds, and are a little bitter to the taste. But humans, via selective breeding, each generation planted seeds from only those plants that were preferred or that were conductive to human contact. So the banana was likely an intentional modification, but most scientists believe the first grains were not intentionally domesticated, as the plants learned that if they could use humans to disperse their seeds, they could have better reproductive success. Of course, modern agriculture is very much directed reproduction. In fact, and it feels weird to call this natural, but one tactic scientists have used to create beneficial mutations in plants is by purposely irradiating them or exposing them to known carcinogens. Using these techniques, the next generation of plants have random but a greater number of genetic mutations. The hope is that some of these will have beneficial properties, maybe resistance to pathogens or a greater resistance to water stress, whatever. But these are still seen as natural, even though I'm not sure if they really qualify as natural. So now let's move on to what is the big bugaboo about GMO, the kind of modification that's done in a lab where genes are inserted into an organism. You may not be aware, but there are two types of gene splicing, intraspecies and interspecies. Interspecies gene splicing is where you take the genes from one plant and implant them into another plant of the same species or family. So essentially, you are speeding up crossbreeding. In fact, this is so much more precise than crossbreeding, because crossbreeding exchanges many genes, and we have no control over what genes are transferred. Intraspecies gene splicing is much more precise, removing only a single segment and implanting it into another host. This is like the safest of all ways to modify the DNA. It is a trait that is well understood and is only one trait that is being transferred. Now, this is also a great source of hope for people who suffer from a great number of metabolic diseases. One of the greatest hopes for the coming century is gene therapy. Gene therapy promises to cure genetically based diseases such as cystic fibrosis, hemophilia, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell anemia, and others. This is a kind of cross between inter and intra-splicing. Why? Because although the gene being transferred is a human gene, the vector, or the actual agent doing the transferring, is a modified virus. Why a virus? Well, first, the raison d'etre is to inject DNA into a cell. Second, the idea of gene therapy is to replace the defective genes found in the afflicted with properly functioning copies of the DNA. You don't want to change just a single cell, but you actually want to change many cells. Non-viral gene splicing is intended to change a single cell, like an egg cell. But gene therapy, you must change many cells in a living body. To date, only one therapy treatment has been approved for general use, but dozens of others are likely to be approved in the near future. Okay, so now we shall discuss the Frankenfood in the room. Why do they use the word Frankenfood? Well, first, it evokes irrational fear, but it's also related to the other type of gene splicing, intraspecies. Intraspecies gene splicing takes a gene from one organism, let's say a flounder, and implants that into another, let's say a tomato. Why? Well, it seems that flounders produce an anti-freezing protein. Once inserted to the tomatoes, it will increase its resistance to frost. Although this is the poster child of the anti-GMO crowd, this product was actually never commercialized. Another cause celeb is BT-enhanced crops. BT is short for Bacillus thuringiensis. This bacteria produces a toxin that kills bugs. This gene has been introduced to corn, among other crops. The BT protein basically turns a caterpillar's guts into Swiss cheese. Now, one might argue that if this protein makes Swiss cheese of a caterpillar's guts, might it not do the same to a human? Well, no. In a simplistic way, we might think that a toxin for one animal is a toxin to all animals. And this is not true. In fact, there are very few universal toxins. So BT is only toxic to a small class of insects. Think about chocolate. Humans love chocolate. Chocolate is very good. Give me more chocolate. But it can kill your dog. So toxic is not toxic to all. Only the fearmongers make such misplaced claims. One thing that is often overlooked by the GMO crowd is the fact that most GMOs are good for the environment. The BT-enhanced corn means that farmers need not administer pesticides that would not only kill the bugs that eat the corn, but all bugs, including monarch butterflies. Don, you might say, that's a weird segue. What's up with monarch butterflies? Well, this is another case of a false flag fear-mongering. You see, some people would state that BT corn, well, it is killing the butterflies and the bees. Okay, I just threw that last one in just because. Well, as it turns out, monarch butterflies don't eat corn. They eat milkweed plants. It also seems that their population decline has been going on for decades, that it is more likely that the loss of habitat, reduction of milkweed population, and parasitism is the real cause for the decline. Now, be aware, there are a few, but only a few, discredited studies that support the idea that BT kills butterflies. And this exemplifies my problem with the whole anti-GMO issue. We could blame BT corn for the decline of the monarch butterfly, or we could address the real problem, deforestation. No, we will demonize corn while the butterflies become extinct regardless. Okay, so that's how we modify organisms. Of course, the current issue revolves around mainly the last type, but only in a very specific instance, our food. There has been much work in genetically modifying bacteria to mass produce spider silk to be used for a host of different applications. Pigs, mice, and other animals have been enhanced, if I may feign immodesty as a humanoid, with human DNA to do everything from study diseases to improve the compatibility of organ transplants. I've heard little, if any, complaint about mosquitoes that have been modified to eradicate malaria, dengue fever, and other tropical diseases that the pest may carry. People seem okay when a bacteria is modified to digest toxic waste, be it oil, plastics, or even radioactive waste. Cows have been modified to produce human breast milk. Pigs have been modified so as to reduce the amount of phosphorus runoff. Phosphorus pollutes our waterway and results in massive die-offs of fish to what scientists call oceanic dead zones because nothing with the exception of algae can live in them. No, it seems these are okay to the anti-GMO groups. The only time they complain is when we're talking about our food. Well, okay, that's not a small thing. It is true that GMOs are most evident in our lives when it comes to food, and I've often railed that we must carefully pick our battles. And that is why I'm against GMO labeling. It creates a false sense of fear that is not substantiated in any of the non-corporate independent research. The anti-GMO advocates often ignore the scientific evidence saying it is all paid for by big biotech companies. And it is true they spend a lot of money in research in the same way that big oil pushes back against climate change. And if that was the only source of information, they would have a point. But they manipulate and misrepresent the scientific consensus on GMO in the precisely same way that climate change denialists do. And I think the real battle here is not against the science of genetic modification, but the corporate control of agriculture. What they hate is Monsanto, Cargill, and how they dominate the grain market, how they use their corporate oligarchy to manipulate government regulations. I think it's immoral that a corporation, or anyone, can have a patent on a gene. Life is life and life is meant to be free. That is wrong to me, and we should fight that. We should ensure proper regulations to ensure that mega corporations like Monsanto can't do the bad things that they're doing, such as monocrops, that we plant the exact same kind of crop everywhere in the world. One small genetic modification in a particular disease could literally wipe out most of the food on this planet. Those are the things that we should be worrying about. If anti-GMO people were calling for a corporate labeling system on food, I'd be all for that. And there is an irony. The reason that the Monsantos of the world don't want GMO labeling is not because they want to poison and kill millions with their supposed toxic foods, but they know that GMO has become a marketing negative, that they would lose sales because the anti-GMOs have made the word toxic, even though the product is not. By lobbying against GMO labeling, it looks like they have something to hide when they're only really worried about market share. Perhaps the best thing is that GMO labeling happens. But I have to say that a large, well-funded campaign must take place at the same time to educate the public about the realities of GMO. not only on our food shelves, but the good they do in the environment and for humanity in general. Well, this is Dawn saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
Cosmos.